That's still not love, Quentin said. All right, Shreve said. Just listen. Rode the 40 miles and into the gates and up to the house. And this time Sutphen wasn't even there. And Ellen didn't even know where he had gone, believing blandly and volubly that he had gone to Memphis or maybe even to St. Louis on business, and Henry and Judith not even caring that much. And only he, Bond, to know where Sutphen had gone, saying to himself, of course. He wasn't sure. He had to go there to make sure. Telling himself that loud now, loud and fast, too, so he would not, could not, hear the thinking, the, but if he suspected, why not have told me? I would have done that, gone to him first, who have the blood after it was tainted and corrupt by whatever it was in mother. Loud and fast now, telling himself, that's what it is, maybe he has gone on ahead to wait for me. He left no message for me here because the others are not to suspect yet, and he knows that I will know at once where he is when I find him gone. Thinking of the two of them, the somber, vengeful woman who was his mother and the grim, rock-like man who had looked at him every day for 10 days with absolutely no alteration of expression at all, facing one another in grim armistice after almost 30 years in that rich Baroque drawing-room in that house which he called home, since apparently everybody seemed to have a home, the man who he was now sure was his father, not humble now either, and he, Bond, proud of that, not saying even now, I was wrong, but I admit that it is so. Jesus, think of his heart then, during those 2 days, with the old gal throwing Judith at him every minute now because she had been spreading the news of the engagement confidentially through the county ever since Christmas. Didn't your father say how she had even taken Judith to Memphis in the spring to buy the trousseau? And Judith, neither having to accede to the throwing nor to resist it, but just being, just existing and breathing like Henry did, who maybe one morning during that spring waked up and lay right still in the bed and took stock, added the figures and drew the balance and told himself, all right, I am trying to make myself into what I think he wants me to be. He can do anything he wants to with me. He has only to tell me what to do and I will do it. Even though what he asked me to do looked to me like dishonor, I would still do it. Only Judith, being a female and so wiser than that, would not even consider dishonor. She would just say, all right. I will do anything he might ask me to do, and that is why he will never ask me to do anything that I consider dishonorable. So that, maybe he even kissed her that time, the first time she had ever been kissed maybe, and she too innocent to be coy or modest or even to know that she had been temporized with. Maybe afterward just looking at him with a kind of peaceful and blank surprise at the fact that your sweetheart apparently kissed you the first time like your brother would. Provided, of course, that your brother ever thought of could be brought to kissing you on the mouth. So that when the 2 days were up and he was gone again, and Ellen shrieking at her, what? No engagement? No troth? No ring? She would be too astonished even to lie about it, because that would be the first time it would have occurred to her that there had been no proposal. Think of his heart then, while he rode to the river, and then on the steamboat itself where he walked up and down the deck, feeling through the deck the engines driving him nearer and nearer day and night to the moment which he must have realized now he had been waiting for ever since he had got big enough to comprehend. Of course, every now and then he would just have to say it pretty fast and loud. That's all it is. He just wants to make sure first, to drown out the old, but why do it this way? Why not back there? He knows that I shall never make any claim upon any part of what he now possesses, gained at the price of what sacrifice and endurance and scorn, so they told me, not he, they, only he knows. Knows that so well that it would never have occurred to him, just as he knows it would never occur to me that this might be his reason. Who is not only generous but ruthless, who must have surrendered everything he and mother owned to her and to me as the price of repudiating her. Not because the doing it this way hurt him, flouted him and kept him in suspense that much unnecessary longer, because he didn't matter, whether he was irked or even crucified didn't matter. It was the fact that he had to be kept constantly reminded that he would not have done it this way himself. Yet he had stemmed from the blood after whatever it was his mother had been or done had tainted and corrupted it. Nearer and nearer, until suspense and puzzlement and haste and all seemed blended into one sublimation of passive surrender, in which he thought only, all right, even this way, even if he wants to do it this way, I will promise never to see her again, never to see him again. Then he reached home, and he never learned if Sutphen had been there or not. He never knew. He believed it, but he never knew. His mother, the same somber, unchanged, fierce paranoiac whom he had left in September, from whom he could learn nothing by indirection and whom he dared not ask outright. The very fact that he saw through the skillful questions of the lawyer as to how he had liked the school and the people of that country and how perhaps, or had he not perhaps, he had made friends up there among the country families, only that much more proof to him at that time that Sutphen had not been there, or at least the lawyer was not aware that he had, since now that he believed he had fathomed the lawyer's design in sending him to that particular school to begin with, he saw nothing in the questions to indicate that the lawyer had learned anything new since. Or what he could have learned in that interview with the lawyer, because it would be a short one. It would be next to the shortest one ever to transpire between them, the shortest one of all next to the last one, of course, the one which would occur in the next summer, when Henry would be with him. Because the lawyer would not dare risk asking him outright, just as he, Bond, did not dare to ask his mother outright. Because, though the lawyer believed him to be rather a fool than dull or dense, yet even he, the lawyer, never for one moment believed that even Bond was going to be the kind of a fool he was going to be. So he told the lawyer nothing, and the lawyer told him nothing, and the summer passed, and September came, and still the lawyer, his mother too, had not once asked him if he wanted to return to the school. So that at last he had to say to himself that he intended to return. And maybe he knew that he had lost that move, since there was nothing whatever in the lawyer's face save an agent's acquiescence. So he returned to school, where Henry was waiting, oh yes, waiting for him, who did not even say, "You didn't answer my letters, you didn't even write to Judith," who had already said, "What my sister and I have and are belongs to you." But maybe he did write to Judith now, by the first nigger post which rode to Sutphen's Hundred, about how it had been an uneventful summer and hence nothing to write about, with maybe Charles Bond plain and inelidable on the outside of the envelope, and he thinking he will have to see that. Maybe he will send it back, thinking, maybe if it comes back nothing will stop me then, and so maybe at last I will know what I am going to do. But it didn't come back, and the others didn't come back. And the fall passed, and Christmas came, and they rode again to Sutphen's Hundred, and this time he was not there again. He was in the field, he had gone to town, he was hunting, something. Sutphen not there when they rode up, and Bond knew he had not expected him to be there, saying, "Now, now, now, it will come now, it will come this time, and I am young, young, because I still don't know what I am going to do." So maybe what he was doing that twilight, because he knew that Sutphen had returned, was now in the house. It would be like a wind, something, dark and chill, breathing upon him, and he stopping, grave, quiet, alert, thinking, what is it? Then he would know. He could feel the other entering the house. And he would let his held breath go quiet and easy, a profound exhalation, his heart quiet too. In the garden, while he walked with Judith and talked to her, gallant and elegant and automatic, and Judith thinking about that like she thought about that first kiss back in the summer. So that's it, that's what love is. Bludgeoned once more by disappointment, but still unbowed. Maybe what he was doing there now was waiting, telling himself, maybe even yet he will send for me, at least say it to me, even though he knew better. He is in the library now, he has sent the nigger for Henry, now Henry is entering the room. So that maybe he stopped and faced her, with something in his face that was smiling now, and took her by the elbows and turned her, easy and gentle, until she faced the house, and said, "Go, I wish to be alone to think about love." And she went just as she took the kiss that day, with maybe the feel of the flat of his hand light and momentary upon her behind. And he stood there facing the house until Henry came out, and they looked at one another for a while with no word said, and then turned and walked together through the garden, across the lot and into the stable, where maybe there was a nigger there, and maybe they saddled the two horses themselves, and waited until the house nigger came with the two repacked saddlebags. And maybe he didn't even say then, "But he sent no word to me." Shreve ceased. That is, for all the two of them, Shreve and Quentin knew he had stopped. Since for all the two of them knew he had never begun, since it did not matter, and possibly neither of them conscious of the distinction, which one had been doing the talking. So that now it was not two but four of them riding the two horses through the dark over the frozen December ruts of that Christmas Eve. Four of them, and then just two, Charles Shreve and Quentin Henry, the two of them both believing that Henry was thinking he, meaning his father, has destroyed us all, not for one moment thinking he, meaning Bond, must have known or at least suspected this all the time. That's why he has acted as he has, why he did not answer my letters last summer nor write to Judith, why he has never asked her to marry him. Believing that that must have occurred to Henry, certainly during that moment after Henry emerged from the house and he and Bond looked at one another for a while without a word, then walked down to the stable and saddled the horses, but that Henry had just taken that in stride because he did not yet believe it, even though he knew that it was true, because he must have now understood with complete despair the secret of his whole attitude toward Bond from that first instinctive moment when he had seen him a year and a quarter ago. He knew, yet he did not, had to refuse to, believe. So it was four of them who rode the two horses through that night and then across the bright frosty North Mississippi Christmas Day, in something very like pariahhood, passing the plantation houses with sprigs of holly thrust beneath the knockers on the doors and mistletoe hanging from the chandeliers, and bowls of eggnog and toddy on tables in the halls, and the blue unwinded wood smoke standing above the plastered chimneys of the slave quarters, to the river and the steamboat. There would be Christmas on the boat, too, the same holly and mistletoe, the same eggnog and toddy. Perhaps, doubtless, a Christmas supper and a ball, but not for them. The two of them in the dark and the cold, standing at the guardrail above the dark water, and still not talking since there was nothing to say. The two of them, the four of them, held in that probation, that suspension, by Henry, who knew but still did not believe, who was going deliberately to look upon and prove to himself that which, so Shreve and Quentin believed, would be like death for him to learn. So it was four of them still who got off the boat in New Orleans, which Henry had never seen before, whose entire cosmopolitan experience, apart from his sojourn at the school, consisted probably of one or two trips to Memphis with his father to buy livestock or slaves, and had no time to look at now. Henry, who knew yet did not believe, and Bond, whom Mr. Compson had called a fatalist, but who, according to Shreve and Quentin, did not resist Henry's dictum and design for the reason that he neither knew nor cared what Henry intended to do, because he had long since realized that he did not yet know what he himself was going to do. Four of them, who sat in that drawing-room of baroque and fusty magnificence which Shreve had invented and which was probably true enough, while the Haiti-born daughter of the French sugar planter and the woman who Sutpen's first father-in-law had told him was a Spaniard, the slight dowdy woman with untidy gray-streaked raven hair, coarse as a horse's tail, with parchment-colored skin and implacable pouched black eyes which alone showed no age because they showed no forgetting, whom Shreve and Quentin had likewise invented and which was likewise probably true enough, told them nothing because she did not need to because she had already told it, who did not say, "My son is in love with your sister," but, "So she has fallen in love with him," and then sat laughing harshly and steadily at Henry, who could not have lied to her even if he would have, who did not even have to answer at all either yes or no. Four of them there, in that room in New Orleans in 1860, just as in a sense there were four of them here in this tomb-like room in Massachusetts in 1910. And Bond may have, probably did, take Henry to call on the octoroon mistress and the child, as Mr. Compson said, though neither Shreve nor Quentin believed that the visit affected Henry as Mr. Compson seemed to think. In fact, Quentin did not even tell Shreve what his father had said about the visit. Perhaps Quentin himself had not been listening when Mr. Compson related, recreated, it that evening at home. Perhaps at that moment on the gallery in the hot September twilight, Quentin took that in stride without even hearing it, just as Shreve would have, since both he and Shreve believed, and were probably right in this too, that the octoroon and the child would have been to Henry only something else about Bond to be not envied but aped, if that had been possible, if there had been time and peace to ape it in. Peace not between men of the same race and nation, but peace between two young embattled spirits and the incontrovertible fact which embattled them. Since neither Henry and Bond, any more than Quentin and Shreve, were the first young men to believe, or at least apparently act on the assumption, that wars were sometimes created for the sole aim of settling youth's private difficulties and discontents. So the old dame asked Henry that one question, and then sat there laughing at him. So he knew then, they both knew then. And so now it would be short, this time with the lawyer, the shortest one of all. Because the lawyer would have been watching him. Maybe there had even been a letter during that second fall, while the lawyer was waiting and still nothing seemed to be happening up there. And maybe the lawyer was the reason why Bond never answered Henry's and Judith's letters during that summer, because he never got them. A letter, two or maybe three pages of your humble and obedient E and T and C, that boiled down to 18 words. I know you are a fool, but just what kind of a fool are you going to be? And Bond was at least enough of a not-fool to do the boiling down. Yes, watching him, not concerned yet, just considerably annoyed, giving Bond plenty of time to come to him, giving him all of a week, maybe, after he, the lawyer, would have contrived to get hold of Henry and find out a good deal of what Henry was thinking without Henry ever knowing it, before he would contrive Bond too, and maybe so good at the contriving that even Bond would not know at once what was coming. It would be a short one. It would be no secret between them now. It would just be unsaid. The lawyer behind the desk, and maybe in the secret drawer, the ledger where he had just finished adding in the last past year's interest compounded between the intrinsic and the love and pride at 200%. The lawyer fretted, annoyed, but not at all concerned, since he not only knew he had the screws, but he still did not really believe that Bond was that kind of a fool, though he was about to alter his opinion somewhat about the dullness, or at least the backwardness. The lawyer watching him and saying, smooth and oily, since it would be no secret now, who would know now that Bond knew all he would ever know or would need to know, to make the coup? Do you know that you are a very fortunate young man? With most of us, even when we are lucky enough to get our revenge, we must pay for it, sometimes in actual dollars. While you are not only in a position to get your revenge, clear your mother's name, but the balm with which you will assuage her injury will have a collateral value which can be translated into the things which a young man needs, which are his due and which, whether we like it or not, may be had only in exchange for hard dollars. And Bond, not saying, what do you mean, and not moving yet, that is, the lawyer would not be aware that he was beginning to move, continuing, the lawyer, smooth and easy, and more than this, than the revenge, is lagniappe to the revenge, as it were. This nosegay of an afternoon, this scentless prairie flower which will not be missed and which might as well bloom in your lapel as in another's. This, how do you young men put it, a nice little piece? And then he would see Bond, maybe the eyes, maybe he would just hear the feet moving. And then pistol, derringer, horse pistol, revolver, whatever it was, and all, he would be crouched back against the wall behind the overturned chair, snarling, "Stand back! Stop!" Then screaming, "Help! Help! Help!" Then just screaming, because he could hear and feel his own wrenching bones before he could free his fingers of the pistol, and his neck bone too, as Bond would strike him with the palm on one cheek and then with the back of the hand on the other. Maybe he could even hear Bond too saying, "Stop it! Hush! I'm not going to hurt you." Or maybe it was the lawyer in him that said the hush, which he obeyed, who got him back into the righted chair again, half lying upon the desk. The lawyer in him that warned him not to say, "You will pay for this," but instead to half lie there, nursing his wrenched hand in his handkerchief while Bond stood looking down at him, holding the pistol by the barrel against his leg, saying, "If you feel that you require satisfaction, of course you know." And the lawyer, sitting back now, dabbing the handkerchief at his cheek now, "I was wrong. I misunderstood your feeling about the matter. I ask your pardon." And Bond, "Granted. As you wish. I will accept either an apology or a bullet, as you prefer." And the lawyer, there would be a faint fading red in his cheek, but that would be all, nothing in the voice or in the eyes. "I see you are going to collect full measure for my unfortunate misconception, even ridicule. Even if I felt that right was on my side, which I do not, I would still have to decline your offer. I would not be your equal with pistols." And Bond, "Nor with knives or rapiers, too," and the lawyer, smooth and easy, "nor knives or rapiers, too." So that now the lawyer wouldn't even need to say, "You will pay for this," because Bond would be saying that for him, who would stand there with the lax pistol, thinking, "But only with knives or pistols or rapiers. So I can't beat him. I could shoot him. I would shoot him with no more compunction than I would a snake or a man who cuckolded me, but he would still beat me. thinking, yes, he did beat me, while he... Listen, Shreve said, cried. It would be while he would be lying in a bedroom of that private house in Corinth after Pittsburgh Landing, while his shoulder got well 2 years later, and the letter from the Octoroon, maybe even the one that contained the photograph of her and the child, finally overtaking him, wailing for money and telling him that the lawyer had departed for Texas or Mexico or somewhere at last, and that she, the Octoroon, could not find his mother either, and so without doubt the lawyer had murdered her before he stole the money, since it would be just like both of them to flee or get themselves killed without providing for her at all. Yes, they knew now. And Jesus, think of him, Bon, who had wanted to know, who had had the most reason to want to know, who, as far as he knew, had never had any father but had been created somehow between that woman who wouldn't let him play with other children, and that lawyer who even told the woman whether or not each time she bought a piece of meat or a loaf of bread. Two people neither of whom had taken pleasure or found passion in getting him or suffered pain and travail in borning him. Who perhaps if one of the two had only told him the truth, none of what happened would ever have come to pass. While there was Henry, who had father and security and contentment and all, yet was told the truth by both of them while he, Bon, was told by neither.
This book is continued on Disc 10.
And Jesus, think of him, Bon, who had wanted to know, who had had the most reason to want to know, who, as far as he knew, had never had any father but had been created somehow between that woman who wouldn't let him play with other children, and that lawyer who even told the woman whether or not each time she bought a piece of meat or a loaf of bread. Two people neither of whom had taken pleasure or found passion in getting him or suffered pain and travail in borning him. Who perhaps if one of the two had only told him the truth, none of what happened would ever have come to pass. While there was Henry, who had father and security and contentment and all, yet was told the truth by both of them while he, Bon, was told by neither. And think of Henry, who had said at first it was a lie, and then when he knew it was not a lie, had still said, I don't believe it. Who had found even in that I don't believe it enough of strength to repudiate home and blood in order to champion his defiance, and in which championing he proved his contention to be the false one, and was more than ever interdict against returning home. Jesus, think of the load he had to carry. Born of two Methodists, or of one long invincible line of Methodists, and raised in provincial North Mississippi, faced with incest of all things that might have been reserved for him, that all his heredity and training had to rebel against on principle, and in a situation where he knew that neither incest nor training was going to help him solve it. So that maybe when they left and walked the streets that night and at last Bond said, well, now what? Henry said, wait, let me get used to it. And maybe it was 2 days or 3 days, and Henry said, you shall not. And then it was Bond that said, wait, I am your older brother. Do you say shall not to me? And maybe it was a week. Maybe Bond took Henry to see the Octoroon, and Henry looked at her and said, ain't that enough for you? And Bond said, do you want it to be enough? And Henry said, wait, I must have time to get used to it. You will have to give me time. Jesus, think how Henry must have talked during that winter and then that spring, with Lincoln elected and the Alabama Convention, and the South began to draw out of the Union. And then there were two presidents in the United States, and the telegraph brought the news about Charleston, and Lincoln called out his army, and it was done, irrevocable now. And Henry and Bon already decided to go without having to consult one another, who would have gone anyway even if they had never seen one another, but certainly now, because after all you don't waste a war. Think how they must have talked, how Henry would say, but must you marry her? Do you have to do it? And Bon would say, he should have told me, myself. Himself. I was fair and honorable with him. I waited. You know now why I waited. I gave him every chance to tell me himself, but he didn't do it. If he had, I would have agreed and promised never to see her or you or him again, but he didn't tell me. I thought at first it was because he didn't know. Then I knew that he did know, and still I waited, but he didn't tell me. He just told you, sent me a message like you send a command by a nigger servant to a beggar or a tramp to clear out. Don't you see that? And Henry would say, but Judith, our sister, think of her. And Bon, all right, think of her, then what? Because they both knew what Judith would do when she found it out, because they both knew that women will show pride and honor about almost anything except love. And Henry said, "Yes, I see, I understand. But you will have to give me time to get used to it. You are my older brother, you can do that little for me." Think of the two of them. Bond, who didn't know what he was going to do and had to say, pretend he did, and Henry, who knew what he was going to do and had to say he didn't. Then it was Christmas again, then 1861, and they hadn't heard from Judith because Judith didn't know for sure where they were because Henry wouldn't let Bond write to her yet. Then they heard about the company, the University Greys, organizing up at Oxford, and maybe they had been waiting for that. So they took the steamboat north again, and more gaiety and excitement on the boat now than Christmas even, like it always is when a war starts, before the scene gets cluttered up with bad food and wounded soldiers and widows and orphans. And them taking no part in it now either, but standing at the rail again above the churning water. And maybe it would be 2 or 3 days, then Henry said suddenly, cried suddenly, "But kings have done it, even dukes! There was that Lorraine duke named John something that married his sister. The Pope excommunicated him, but it didn't hurt. It didn't hurt. They were still husband and wife. They were still alive. They still loved." Then again, loud, fast, "But you will have to wait. You will have to give me time. Maybe the war will settle it, and we won't need to." And maybe this was one place where your old man was right. And they rode into Oxford without touching Sutpen's Hundred and signed the company roster and then hid somewhere to wait. And Henry let Bond write Judith one letter. They would send it by hand, by a nigger that would steal into the quarters by night and give it to Judith's maid. And Judith sent the picture in the metal case, and they rode on ahead to wait until the company got through making flags and riding about the state telling girls farewell and started for the front. Jesus, think of them. Because Bond would know what Henry was doing, just as he had always known what Henry was thinking since that first day when they had looked at one another. Maybe he would know all the better what Henry was doing because he did not know what he himself was going to do, that he would not know until all of a sudden some day it would burst clear and he would know then that he had known all the time what it would be. So he didn't have to bother about himself, and so all he had to do was just to watch Henry trying to reconcile what he, Henry, knew he was going to do with all the voices of his heredity and training which said, "No, no, you cannot, you must not, you shall not." Maybe they would even be under fire now, with the shells rushing and rumbling past overhead and bursting, and them lying there waiting to charge, and Henry would cry again, "But that Lorraine Duke did it. There must have been lots in the world who have done it that people don't know about, that maybe they suffered for it and died for it and are in hell now for it, but they did it and it don't matter now. Even the ones we do know about are just names now and it don't matter now." And Bond, watching him and listening to him and thinking, "It's because I don't know myself what I am going to do, and so he is aware that I am undecided without knowing that he is aware. Perhaps if I told him now that I am going to do it, he would know his own mind and tell me, 'You shall not.'" And maybe your old man was right this time, and they did think maybe the war would settle it, and they would not have to themselves. Or at least maybe Henry hoped it would, because maybe your old man was right here too, and Bond didn't care. That since both of the two people who could have given him a father had declined to do it, nothing mattered to him now, revenge or love or all. Since he knew now that revenge could not compensate him nor love assuage. Maybe it wasn't even Henry who wouldn't let him write to Judith, but Bond himself who did not write her, because he didn't care about anything, not even that he didn't know yet what he was going to do. Then it was the next year, and Bond was an officer now, and they were moving toward Shiloh without knowing that either, talking again as they moved along in column, the officer dropping back alongside the file in which the private marched, and Henry crying again, holding his desperate and urgent voice down to undertone, "Don't you know yet what you are going to do?" While Bond would look at him for a moment with that expression which could have been smiling. "Suppose I told you I did not intend to go back to her." And Henry would walk there beside him with his pack and his 8 feet of musket. And he would begin to pant, panting and panting, while Bond watched him. "I am out in front of you a lot now, going into battle, charging. I will be out in front of you." And Henry panting, "Stop, stop." And Bond watching him with that faint, thin expression about the mouth and eyes. And who would ever know? You would not even have to know for certain yourself, because who could say but what a Yankee ball might have struck me at the exact second you pulled your trigger, or even before. And Henry panting and looking, glaring at the sky, with his teeth showing and the sweat on his face and the knuckles of the hand on his musket butt white, saying, panting, "Stop, stop, stop, stop!" Then it was Shiloh, the second day in the lost battle, and the brigade falling back from Pittsburgh Landing. "And listen," Shreve cried, "wait now, wait!" Glaring at Quentin, panting himself as if he had had to supply his shade not only with the cue but with breath to obey it in. "Because your old man was wrong here, too. He said it was Bonn who was wounded, but it wasn't. Because who told him? Who told Sutphen, or your grandfather either, which of them it was who was hit? Sutphen didn't know because he wasn't there, and your grandfather wasn't there either, because that was where he was hit, too, where he lost his arm. So who told them? Not Henry, because his father never saw Henry but that one time, and maybe they never had time to talk about wounds, and besides, to talk about wounds in the Confederate Army in 1865 would be like coal miners talking about soot. And not Bonn, because Sutphen never saw him at all, because he was dead. It was not Bonn, it was Henry. Bonn that found Henry at last and stooped to pick him up, and Henry fought back, struggled, saying, 'Let be, let me die, I won't have to know it then.' And Bonn said, 'So do you want me to go back to her?' And Henry lay there struggling and panting, with the sweat on his face and his teeth bloody inside his chewed lip. And Bonn said, 'Say you do want me to go back to her. Maybe then I won't do it. Say it.' And Henry lay there struggling, with the fresh red staining through his shirt and his teeth showing and the sweat on his face, until Bonn held his arms and lifted him onto his back. First two of them, then four, now two again. The room was indeed tomb-like, a quality stale and static and moribund beyond any mere vivid and living cold. Yet they remained in it, though not 30 feet away was bed and warmth. Quentin had not even put on his overcoat, which lay on the floor where it had fallen from the arm of the chair where Shreve had put it down. They did not retreat from the cold. They both bore it as though in deliberate, flagellant exaltation of physical misery transmogrified into the spirit's travail of the two young men during that time 50 years ago, or 48 rather, then 47 and then 46, since it was 64 and then 65, and the starved and ragged remnant of an army having retreated across Alabama and Georgia and into Carolina, swept onward not by a victorious army behind it, but rather by a mounting tide of the names of lost battles from either side, Chickamauga and Franklin, Vicksburg and Corinth and Atlanta. Battles lost not alone because of superior numbers and failing ammunition and stores, but because of generals who should not have been generals, who were generals not through training in contemporary methods or aptitude for learning them, but by the divine right to say, "Go there," conferred upon them by an absolute caste system, or because the generals of it never lived long enough to learn how to fight massed, cautious, accretionary battles, since they were already as obsolete as Richard or Roland or Du Guesclin, who wore plumes and cloaks lined with scarlet at 28 and 30 and 32 and captured warships with cavalry charges, but no grain nor meat nor bullets, who would whip 3 separate armies in as many days and then tear down their own fences to cook meat robbed from their own smokehouses, who on one night and with a handful of men would gallantly set fire to and destroy a $1 million garrison of enemy supplies, and on the next night be discovered by a neighbor in bed with his wife and be shot to death. 2, 4, now 2 again, according to Quentin and Shreve, the 2, the 4, the 2 still talking. The one who did not yet know what he was going to do, the other who knew what he would have to do yet could not reconcile himself. Henry, citing himself authority for incest, talking about his Duke John of Lorraine as if he hoped possibly to evoke that condemned and excommunicated shade to tell him in person that it was all right, as people both before and since have tried to evoke God or devil to justify them in what their glands insisted upon. The 2, the 4, the 2, facing one another in the tomb-like room. Shreve, the Canadian, the child of blizzards and of cold, in a bathrobe with an overcoat above it, the collar turned up about his ears. Quentin, the southerner, the morose and delicate offspring of rain and steamy heat in the thin, suitable clothing which he had brought from Mississippi, his overcoat, as thin and vain for what it was, as the suit, lying on the floor where he had not even bothered to raise it. The winter of 64 now, the army retreated across Alabama, into Georgia. Now Carolina was just at their backs, and Bonn, the officer, thinking, "We will either be caught and annihilated, or old Joe will extricate us, and we will make contact with Lee in front of Richmond, and then we will at least have the privilege of surrender." And then one day all of a sudden he thought of it, remembered, how that Jefferson regiment of which his father was now colonel was in Longstreet's corps, and maybe from that moment the whole purpose of the retreat seemed to him to be that of bringing him within reach of his father, to give his father one more chance. So that it must have seemed to him now that he knew at last why he had not been able to decide what he wanted to do. Maybe he thought for just a second, "My God, I'm still young. Even after these 4 years, I am still young." But just for a second, because maybe in the same breath he said, "All right, then I am young. But I still believe, even though what I believe probably is that war, suffering, these 4 years of keeping his men alive and able in order to swap them blood and flesh for the largest amount of ground at its bargain price, will have changed him, which I know that it does not do, to where he will say to me not, 'Forgive me, but you are my oldest son, protect your sister, never see either of us again.'" Then it was 65, and what was left of the Army of the West, with nothing remaining now but the ability to walk backwards slow and stubborn, and to endure musketry and shelling. Maybe they didn't even miss the shoes and overcoats and food any more now, and that was why he could write about the captured stove polish like he did in the letter to Judith when he finally knew what he was going to do at last, and told Henry, and Henry said, "Thank God, thank God." Not for the incest, of course, but because at last they were going to do something. At last he could be something, even though that something was the irrevocable repudiation of the old heredity and training, and the acceptance of eternal damnation. Maybe he could even quit talking about his Lorraine Duke then, because he could say now, "It isn't yours, nor his, nor the Pope's hell that we are all going to. It's my mother's and her mother's and father's, and their mother's and father's hell. And it isn't you who are going there, but we, the three, no, four of us. And so at last we will all be together where we belong, since even if only he went there, we would still have to be there too, since the three of us are just illusions that he begot, and your illusions are a part of you like your bones and flesh and memory. And we will all be together in torment, and so we will not need to remember love and fornication. And maybe in torment you cannot even remember why you are there. And if we cannot remember all this, it can't be much torment." Then they were in Carolina that January and February of 65, and what was left of them had been walking backward for almost a year now, and the distance between them and Richmond was less far than the distance they had come. The distance between them and the end a good deal less far. But to Barnett was not the space between them and defeat, but the space between him and the other regiment, between him and the hour, the moment. "He will not even have to ask me. I will just touch flesh with him, and I will say it myself. You will not need to worry. She shall never see me again." Then in March in Carolina, and still the walking backward, slow and stubborn, and listening to the northward now, because there was nothing to hear from any other direction, because in all the other directions it was finished now. And all they expected to hear from the north was defeat. Then one day, he was an officer, he would have known, heard, that Lee had detached some troops and sent them down to reinforce them. Perhaps he even knew the names and numbers of the regiments before they arrived. He saw Sutphen. Maybe that first time Sutphen actually did not see him. Maybe that first time he could tell himself, "That was why he didn't see me." So that he had to put himself in Sutphen's way, make his chance and situation. Then for the second time he looked at the expressionless and rock-like face, at the pale, boring eyes in which there was no flicker, nothing, the face in which he saw his own features, in which he saw recognition, and that was all. That was all, there was nothing further now. Perhaps he just breathed once, quietly, with on his own face that expression which might at a glance have been called smiling, while he thought, "I could force him, I could go to him and force him," knowing that he would not, because it was all finished now. That was all of it, now and at last. And maybe it was that same night, or maybe a night a week later, while they were stopped, because even Sherman would have to stop sometimes at night, with the fires burning for warmth at least, because at least warmth is cheap and doesn't remain consumed, that Barnes said, "Henry," and said, "It won't be much longer now, and then there won't be anything left. We won't even have anything to do left, not even the privilege of walking backward slowly for a reason, for the sake of honor and what's left of pride. Not God, evidently we have done without him for 4 years, only he just didn't think to notify us. And not only not shoes and clothing, but not even any need for them. And not only no land, nor any way to make food, but no need for the food, since we have learned to live without that too. And so if you don't have God, and you don't need food and clothes and shelter, there isn't anything for honor and pride to climb on and hold to and flourish. and if you haven't got honor and pride, then nothing matters. Only there is something in you that doesn't care about honor and pride, yet that lives, that even walks backward for a whole year just to live. That probably even when this is over, and there is not even defeat left, will still decline to sit still in the sun and die, but will be out in the woods, moving and seeking where just will and endurance could not move it, grubbing for roots and such. The old mindless, sentient, undreaming meat that doesn't even know any difference between despair and victory, Henry. And then Henry would begin to say, thank God, panting and saying, thank God, saying, don't try to explain it, just do it. And Bon, you authorize me? As her brother, you give me permission? And Henry, brother, you are the oldest, why do you ask me? And Bon, no, he has never acknowledged me. He just warned me. You are the brother and the son. Do I have your permission, Henry? And Henry, right. So Bon wrote the letter after the 4 years, and Henry read it and sent it off. But they didn't quit then and follow the letter. They still walked backward, slow and stubborn, listening toward the north for the end of it, because it takes an awful lot of character to quit anything when you are losing. And they had been walking backward slow for a year now, so all they had left was not the will but just the ability, the grooved habit to endure. Then one night they had stopped again since Sherman had stopped again, and an orderly came along the bivouac line and found Henry at last and said, Sutphen, the colonel, wants you in his tent. And so you and the old dame, the Aunt Rosa, went out there that night, and the old nigger Clytie tried to stop her. She held your arm and said, don't let her go up there, young marster. But you couldn't stop her either because she was strong with 43 years of hate like 43 years of raw meat, and all Clytie had was just 45 or 50 years of despair and waiting. And you didn't even want to be there at all to begin with. And you couldn't stop her either. And then you saw that Clytie's trouble wasn't anger nor even distrust. It was terror, fear. And she didn't tell you in so many words because she was still keeping that secret for the sake of the man who had been her father too, as well as for the sake of the family which no longer existed, whose heretofore inviolate and rotten mausoleum she still guarded. Didn't tell you in so many words any more than she told you in so many words how she had been in the room that day when they brought Bond's body in. And Judith took from his pocket the metal case she had given him with her picture in it. She didn't tell you, it just came out of the terror and the fear after she turned you loose and caught the Aunt Rosa's arm, and the Aunt Rosa turned and struck her hand away and went on to the stairs, and Clytie ran at her again, and this time the Aunt Rosa stopped and turned on the second step and knocked Clytie down with her fist like a man would, and turned and went on up the stairs. And Clytie lay there on the floor, more than 80 years old and not much more than 5 feet tall and looking like a little bundle of clean rags, so that you went and took her arm and helped her up, and her arm felt like a stick, as light and dry and brittle as a stick. And she looked at you and you saw it was not rage but terror, and not nigger terror because it was not about herself but was about whatever it was that was upstairs, that she had kept hidden up there for almost 4 years. And she didn't tell you in the actual words, because even in the terror she kept the secret. Nevertheless, she told you, or at least all of a sudden you knew. He ceased again. It was just as well, since he had no listener. Perhaps he was aware of it. Then suddenly he had no talker either, though possibly he was not aware of this. Because now neither of them was there. They were both in Carolina, and the time was 46 years ago. And it was not even 4 now, but compounded still further, since now both of them were Henry Sutphen and both of them were Bon, compounded each of both, yet either, neither, smelling the very smoke which had blown and faded away 46 years ago from the bivouac fires burning in a pine grove, the gaunt and ragged men sitting or lying about them, talking not about the war, yet all curiously enough, or perhaps not curiously at all, facing the south where further on in the darkness the pickets stood. The pickets who, watching to the south, could see the flicker and gleam of the federal bivouac fires myriad and faint and encircling half the horizon, and counting 10 fires for each Confederate one, and between whom and which, rebel picket and Yankee fire, the Yankee outposts watched the darkness also, the 2 picket lines so close that each could hear the challenge of the other's officers passing from post to post and dying away. And when gone, the voice invisible, cautious, not loud, yet carrion. Hey, Reb, Yeah. Where are you fellers going? Richmond? So are we. Why not wait for us? We air. The men about the fires would not hear this exchange, though they would presently hear the orderly plainly enough as he passes from fire to fire, asking for sutpin and being directed on, and so reaches the fire at last, the smoldering log, with his monotonous speech, "Sutpin, I'm looking for sutpin," until Henry sits up and says, "Here." He is gaunt and ragged and unshaven. Because of the last 4 years, and because he had not quite got his height when the 4 years began, he is not as tall by 2 inches as he gave promise of being, and not as heavy by 30 pounds as he probably will be a few years after he has outlived the 4 years, if he do outlive them. "Here," he says, "what is it?" "The colonel wants you." The orderly does not return with him. Instead, he walks alone through the darkness along a rutted road, a road rutted and cut and churned where the guns have passed over it that afternoon, and reaches the tent at last, one of the few tents, the canvas wall gleaming faintly from a candle within, the silhouette of a sentry before it, who challenges him. "Sutpin," Henry says, "the colonel sent for me." The sentry gestures him into the tent. He stoops through the entrance, the canvas falls behind him as someone, the only occupant of the tent, rises from a camp chair behind the table on which the candle sits. His shadows swooping high and huge up the canvas wall. He, Henry, comes to salute, facing a gray sleeve with colonel's braid on it, one bearded cheek, a jutting nose, a shaggy droop of iron-riddled hair, a face which Henry does not recognize, not because he has not seen it in 4 years and does not expect to see it here and now, but rather because he is not looking at it. He just salutes the braided cuff and stands so until the other says, "Henry." Even now Henry does not start. He just stands so, the two of them stand so, looking at one another. It is the older man who moves first, though they meet in the center of the tent, where they embrace and kiss before Henry is aware that he has moved, was gone to move. Moved by what of close blood which in the reflex instant arrogates and reconciles, even though it does not yet, perhaps never will, forgive. Who stands now while his father holds his face between both hands, looking at it. "Henry," Sutpin says, "my son." Then they sit, one on either side of the table, in the chairs reserved for officers, the table, an open map lies on it, and the candle between them. "You were hit at Shiloh, Colonel Willow tells me," Sutpin says. "Yes, sir," Henry says. He is about to say, "Charles carried me back," but he does not, because already he knows what is coming. He does not even think, surely Judith didn't write him about that letter, or it was Clytie who sent him word somehow that Charles has written her. He thinks neither of these. To him it is logical and natural that their father should know of his and Bond's decision. That rapport of blood which should bring Bond to decide to write, himself to agree to it, and their father to know of it at the same identical instant, after a period of 4 years, out of all time. Now it does come, almost exactly as he has known that it will. "I have seen Charles Bond, Henry." Henry says nothing. It is coming now. He says nothing, he merely stares at his father. The two of them in leaf-faded gray, a single candle, a crude tent walling them away from a darkness where alert pickets face one another, and where weary men sleep without shelter, waiting for dawn and the firing, the weary backward walking to commence again. Yet in a second tent, candle, gray, and all are gone, and it is the holly-decked Christmas library at Sutpin's Hundred, 4 years ago, and the table not a camp table suitable for the spreading of maps, but the heavy carved rosewood one at home with the group photograph of his mother and sister and himself sitting upon it. His father behind the table, and behind his father the window above the garden where Judith and Bond strolled in that slow rhythm where the heart matches the footsteps, and the eyes need only look at one another. "You are going to let him marry Judith, Henry." Still Henry does not answer. It has all been said before, and now he has had 4 years of bitter struggle, following which, whether it be victory or defeat which he has gained, at least he has gained it and has peace now, even if the peace be mostly despair. "He cannot marry her, Henry." Now Henry speaks. "You said that before. I told you then. And now, it won't be much longer now, and then we won't have anything left. Honor, nor pride, nor God, since God quit us 4 years ago, only he never thought it necessary to tell us. No shoes nor clothes, and no need for them. Not only no land to make food out of, but no need for the food, and when you don't have God and honor and pride, and nothing matters except that there is the old mindless meat that don't even care if it was defeat or victory, that won't even die, that will be out in the woods and fields, grubbing up roots and weeds. Yes, I have decided, brother or not, I have decided. I will. I will.
He must not marry her, Henry.
Yes, I said yes at first, but I was not decided then. I didn't let him. But now I have had 4 years to decide in. I will. I'm going to.
He must not marry her, Henry.
His mother's father told me that her mother had been a Spanish woman.
I believed him. It was not until after he was born that I found out that his mother was part Negro.
Nor did Henry ever say that he did not remember leaving the tent.
He remembers all of it.
He remembers stooping through the entrance again and passing the sentry again. He remembers walking back down the cut and rutted road, stumbling in the dark among the ruts on either side of which the fires have now died to embers, so that he can barely distinguish the men sleeping on the earth about them. It must be better than 11 o'clock, he thinks, and another 8 miles tomorrow. If it were only not for those damned guns. Why doesn't old Joe give the guns to Sherman? Then we could make 20 miles a day. We could join Lee, then. At least Lee stops and fights some of the time.
He remembers it. He remembers how he did not return to his fire, but stopped presently in a lonely place, and leaned against a pine, leaning quietly and easily, with his head back so he could look up at the shabby, shaggy branches like something in wrought iron spreading motionless against the chill, vivid stars of early spring. Thinking, I hope he remembers to thank Colonel Willow for letting us use his tent. Thinking not what he would do, but what he would have to do. Because he knew what he would do, it now depended on what Bond would do, would force him to do, since he knew that he would do it. So I must go to him, he thought, thinking, now it is better than 2 o'clock, and it will be dawn soon. Then it was dawn, or almost, and it was cold. A chill which struck through the worn, patched, thin clothing, through the something of weariness and undernourishment, the passive ability, not the volitional will, to endure. There was light somewhere, enough of it for him to distinguish Bond's sleeping face from among the others where he lay wrapped in his blankets beneath his spread cloak. Enough light for him to wake Bond by and for Bond to distinguish his face, or perhaps something communicated by Henry's hand. Because Bond does not speak, demand to know who it is, he merely rises and puts the cloak about his shoulders and approaches the smoldering fire and is kicking it into a blaze when Henry speaks. Wait. Bond pauses and looks at Henry. Now he can see Henry's face. He says, You will be cold. You are cold now. You haven't been asleep, have you? Here. He swings the cloak from his shoulders and holds it out. No, Henry says. Yes, take it. I'll get my blanket. Bond puts the cloak about Henry and goes and takes up his tumbled blanket and swings it about his shoulders, and they move aside and sit on a log. Now it is dawn. The east is gray. It will be primrose soon, and then red with firin', and once more the weary backward marchin' will begin, retreatin' from annihilation, fallin' back upon defeat, though not quite yet. There will be a little time yet for them to sit side by side upon the log in the makin' light of dawn, the one in the cloak, the other in the blanket. Their voices are not much louder than the silent dawn itself. So it's the miscegenation, not the incest, which you can't bear. Henry doesn't answer. And he sent me no word? He did not ask you to send me to him? No word to me, no word at all? That was all he had to do now, today. 4 years ago, or at any time during the 4 years, that was all. He would not have needed to ask it, require it of me. I would have offered it. I would have said I will never see her again before he could have asked it of me. He did not have to do this, Henry. He didn't need to tell you I am a nigger to stop me. He could have stopped me without that, Henry. No, Henry cries. No, no, I'll... He springs up. His face is working. Bond can see his teeth within the soft beard which covers his sunken cheeks, and the whites of Henry's eyes as though the eyeballs struggled in their sockets as the pantin' breath struggled in his lungs. The pantin' which ceased, the breath held, the eyes too looking down at him where he sat on the log, the voice now not much louder than an expelled breath.
"You said, could have stopped you. What do you mean by that?"
Now it is Bond who does not answer, who sits on the log looking at the face stooped above him. Henry says, still in that voice, no louder than breathing, "But now? You mean you—"
"Yes. What else can I do now? I gave him the choice. I have been giving him the choice for 4 years."
"Think of her, not of me, of her."
"I have. For 4 years. Of you and her. Now I am thinking of myself."
"No," Henry says, "no, no."
"I cannot."
"You shall not."
"Who will stop me, Henry?"
"No," Henry says, "no, no, no."
Now it is Bond who watches Henry. He can see the whites of Henry's eyes again as he sits looking at Henry with that expression which might be called smiling. His hand vanishes beneath the blanket and reappears, holding his pistol by the barrel, the butt extended toward Henry.
"Then do it now," he says.
Henry looks at the pistol. Now he is not only panting, he is trembling. When he speaks now, his voice is not even the exhalation, it is the suffused and suffocating in-breath itself.
"You are my brother."
"No, I'm not. I'm the nigger that's going to sleep with your sister, unless you stop me, Henry."
Suddenly Henry grasps the pistol, jerks it free of Bond's hand, and stands so, the pistol in his hand, panting and panting. Again Bond can see the whites of his inrolled eyes while he sits on the log and watches Henry with that faint expression about the eyes and mouth which might be smiling.
"Do it now, Henry," he says. Henry whirls. In the same motion he hurls the pistol from him and stoops again, gripping Bond by both shoulders, panting.
"You shall not," he says. "You shall not. Do you hear me?"
Bond does not move beneath the gripping hands. He sits motionless, with his faint fixed grimace. His voice is gentler than that first breath in which the pine branches begin to move a little.
"You will have to stop me, Henry."
"And he never slipped away," Shreve said. "He could have, but he never even tried. Jesus, maybe he even went to Henry and said, 'I'm going, Henry.' And maybe they left together and rode side by side, dodging Yankee patrols all the way back to Mississippi and right up to that gate. Side by side, and it only then that one of them ever rode ahead or dropped behind, and that when Henry spurred ahead and turned his horse to face Bond and took out the pistol. And Judith and Clytie heard the shot, and maybe Wash Jones was hanging around somewhere in the backyard, and so he was there to help Clytie and Judith carry him into the house and lay him on the bed. And Wash went to town to tell the Aunt Rosa, and the Aunt Rosa comes boiling out that afternoon and finds Judith standing without a tear before the closed door, holding the metal case she had given him with her picture in it, but that didn't have her picture in it now but that of the Octoroon and the kid. And your old man wouldn't know about that, too. Why the black son of a bitch should have taken her picture out and put the Octoroon's picture in, so he invented a reason for it. But I know. And you know, too. Don't you? Don't you, huh?" He glared at Quentin, leaning forward over the table now, looking huge and shapeless as a bear in his swaddling of garments. "Don't you know? It was because he said to himself, 'If Henry don't mean what he said, it will be all right. I can take it out and destroy it. But if he does mean what he said, it will be the only way I will have to say to her, I was no good. Do not grieve for me.' Ain't that right? Ain't it? By God, ain't it?"
"Yes," Quentin said.
"Come on," Shreve said. "Let's get out of this refrigerator and go to bed."